Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 19th of March. This hour, Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. People all over the world are talking about this, and they are haunted by the unknown whereabouts of the 239 passengers and crew. With so little information, Chinese relatives of passengers on the plane have threatened to go on hunger strike unless Malaysian authorities release the truth about what happened. What do we know that is important about what did happen? What might have happened? Where could the plane be? This hour, Bruce Roger is with us. He's a pilot who has over 25 years of aviation experience. He is a Gulf War veteran, is a reserve pilot for the U.S. Air Force, is a commercial airlines pilot, and he wrote a piece for the New York Daily News that caught our attention. Disabled systems suggest someone wanted Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 off the grid. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. I would imagine, because we're all talking about this, that you have your thoughts and theories, and we all just have theories at this point. Our phone number for you to join the conversation with Bruce is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We are also on Twitter at @KDunnShow. Bruce is president of Aero Consulting Experts and is an aviation expert witness who specializes in military, corporate, and commercial flight operations. Bruce, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Oh, well, thank you, Kathleen, for having me on your show.
Yeah, our pleasure.
Good afternoon.
You wrote in that newspaper piece that I mentioned that initially you thought a sudden catastrophic event had taken place. The pilots didn't have time for a mayday call. But now you write the information available points to an ominous series of events. What are those events?
Well, what we know is, for the as far as our factual information that we've gathered thus far, is that we know that the pilots didn't make a distress call. We also know that the ACARS, that's the aircraft reporting system, which is almost like a chat room, if you would, between the pilots and people on the ground or the company or ATC, that was also disabled. So we know those two things have been disabled. We also know the transponder was turned off, and that's the equipment that ATC, Air Traffic Control, uses to get precise information on the airplane. Its altitude, its airspeed, its location, that was also disabled. So these are the facts that we know. We also know that this took place after they left Malaysian Air Traffic Control's airspace. So they are now what's considered a non-radar environment.
Hmm.
So these are the facts. Now, we also obviously know the airplane's missing. We know that there's no emergency locator transmitters. These are the ELTs that would go off that are water activated, or they're also activated by a deceleration of force. And we don't have those pinging at all. And we have no wreckage. We have no seats floating in the water. We don't have any clue where this airplane is at the moment.
Can you remember any time in aviation history, which I'm sure you're intimately familiar with, when something like this has happened?
Well, not like this. I mean, we've had, airplanes, unfortunately, go down. Air France recently off the coast of South America, and a couple other aircraft have impacted the water, but we found them. We knew what was going on. We were able to pinpoint their location. This is definitely far beyond anything that we've ever seen before.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk about all that had to be done in the cockpit, you have said that to find one particular circuit breaker, you would have to be a 777 pilot or an expert who is trained in that model of aircraft. You'd have to know what you were doing.
Well, let's back up a little bit. Now, there are two possibilities, two scenarios here, and both scenarios kind of lead the same way, except one is definitely more ominous than the other one. The scenario that we're talking about, where the pilot, where somebody would have to pull a circuit breaker, we're talking about the ACAR system. The ACAR system, again, is that chat room that we use between the pilots and whoever we want to talk to. However, the airplane is also using that same system to report the health of the engines, the health of the airframe. Anything that's kind of unusual will be reported through that system to somebody on the ground that's receiving the information. It doesn't happen very often. The 777 is a very safe airplane, but occasionally we'll be flying, let's say, for me it was a 747, and we're just flying along between San Francisco and Hong Kong, and all of a sudden we get a message from dispatch through the ACAR system that says, hey, look at the circuit breaker. We think it's popped. So we would go and find it, and we'd go fix it because the airplane automatically reported that to our maintenance facilities.
I see.
And in this case, the airplane reports automatically through the system. So if you didn't want that to happen, if you didn't want to know where the airplane was at a precise moment in time, you would have to disable that system. And the only way to do that is through a circuit breaker because there's no on-off switch on that system.
Mm-hmm. There was a news conference yesterday in which the Chinese and most of the passengers were Chinese. Family members were being notified as to what the latest news was, and understandably, they are beside themselves. They're very, very distraught. I guess they threw bottles at the Malaysian spokesperson and said that they were about to go on a hunger strike. Their claim was that they're just not being told the truth here. Is it possible that there's a lot more information somewhere, Bruce, that is just not being disclosed, or could it be that we just that we know very little?
I think both are a possibility, Kathleen. I think that right now they are trying very hard to find this aircraft, but it's almost like finding a needle in a haystack. It's a very big ocean. There's a lot of land this airplane could have flown over, and I just don't think they know. I think the things that they do know, they're trying to release. For example, we know about the simulator that was at the captain's home. This is a very high-tech simulator. I've never seen anything quite like it before.
Really?
Yeah, especially, I know a lot of pilots, and, you know, we come home, we kind of want to put that aside for a little while and spend time with our families. It's very unusual to have this level of sophistication in the simulator, especially for a captain. However, he could be very much into this stuff, and but they are releasing information. We know that there were some files that were erased on that simulator today. So they are releasing information, and I just really don't think they have much to go on at this point.
Mm-hmm. The U.S. FBI is involved. There are evidently, we're allowing satellites to try and get pictures, perhaps, of what's in the ocean, or of what use are satellites in helping us trace where this plane could be?
The satellites, you know, if they were pointing in the right direction at the time, would be taking photos. I don't know if you remember in the very beginning days of this, actually probably I think it was 5 days after the airplane went missing, the Chinese released some photographs from their satellites. And it turned out that those photos didn't help or materialize to anything with this incident. So the satellites would be looking for things on the surface. And, again, you'd have to kind of point that soda straw, so to speak, in the area that you think that the airplane might be, and it's a very large search area.
Mm-hmm. When you, and I'm sure that you've thought about this, we're about to go to phone calls, and our lines were jammed the minute I said you were going to be our guest, so we'll go to phone calls in a moment. But what do you think, Bruce? Can you tell us what you think happened?
So, obviously, I've been asked this question quite a bit.
I'm sure.
And our company, in that we provide consulting services to attorneys around the nation, have been asked the same question. And, you know, there's really two scenarios here. And each scenario, the very beginning of each scenario turns out to be the same. So I'll describe them to you briefly, and then we can go from there. So scenario one. There was some sort of catastrophic event that took place on that aircraft, whether it be a rapid decompression or some type of smoke and fumes or a fire. And the very first thing the pilot would do is aviate the airplane, navigate, and communicate. So he's going to aviate by taking care of himself, putting his oxygen mask on, establishing crew communications with the co-pilot, and then turning the airplane to the closest field possible. And he would do that by manipulating the autopilot through the flight computer system, and he would turn the airplane. It would be a gentle turn, and then he would also start a descent more than likely, especially in a rapid decompression situation. In this scenario, let's say it's a fire, circuit breakers might be popping because they're hot. They're thermal activated circuit breakers, and the ACAR circuit breaker could have popped, the ELT could have come offline, the radios could have come offline, the pilots could have been incapacitated and not able to make a radio call. All kinds of things happen when an airplane has a catastrophic event, and it's hard to pinpoint what that is until you find the aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very likely scenario. So the airplane turns, it descends, then people have lost consciousness, the airplane flies in its last commands, which could be a low altitude and a heading off into wherever it would go until it ran out of fuel. The other scenario that people are looking at, and you need to look at this because if the airplane has landed someplace, it needs to be found. The other scenario is somebody physically pulled the circuit breaker to the ACARS, they turned off the ELT, they silenced the radios, and they took the airplane off the grid. For what reason, who knows? But these are the two likely scenarios, and both need to be examined to the fullest extent possible.
Yeah. All right, let's go to our mini phone calls. Peter is our first caller in Appleton. Hi, Peter.
Yes, hello.
Hi. Go ahead, Peter.
Hello.
Hi, Peter. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to say there's been no talk of, like, what, there's 200 passengers and none of them have cell phones that are activating a GPS signal that someone could trace, you know, because I hear of all these lost people and they're always found, you know, because their GPS and their phone worked. And so if that's not the case, or if it is, there'd have to be 200 people or 100. Well, if the signal's gone from all of them, voluntarily or not, that would mean that it's pretty bad.
Yeah, it's a good question. There hasn't been any cell phone communication, has there?
No, there has not. And, Peter, that's a great question. A couple things need to happen for your cell phone to work. You have to be within a cell phone tower range, unless you're connected through Wi-Fi, through a satellite signal. But obviously there are no antennas out over the oceans, especially at that altitude, and their specific location between the Malaysian continent and Vietnam, Malaysian country and Vietnam. There's no way you would be able to use a cell phone in that airspace unless it was hooked up through a Wi-Fi through SATCOM, and that's something that we don't have clarity on at this point, if this airplane had SATCOM with Wi-Fi that the passengers could use. It's fairly new technology that's coming out, and not all airplanes have those yet.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Peter, for your call. Let's go to Robin in Madison. Hi, Robin.
Hi there. My question was on the same thing, but with the electrical fire idea, I mean, if there was a fire in the grid, that would blow the system where he wouldn't be able to communicate or speak. And the other thing is, if it was somebody took the plane, that's a lot of people to make disappear without any communication, without any, you know, hearing from somebody somewhere.
Right.
So I'd just like him to comment on that.
All right. Thank you, Robin.
Okay, Robin, absolutely. The electrical fire scenario or catastrophic event on the airplane can affect various systems. You're absolutely right. It could take the ACAR's circuit breakers offline. Again, that circuit breaker is a thermal circuit breaker used to prevent further damage to other systems on board the airplane. Those circuit breakers are located throughout the cockpit. There must be over 300 of them, and they are thermally activated. So, yes, if you have a catastrophic heat event, it's very possible that not only did that circuit breaker pop, but a whole bunch of other ones, including the radios, including the ELT, including the transponder, and it could have degraded the autopilot system. However, the pilots were still able to manage that system until perhaps they lost consciousness due to the amount of smoke inside the cockpit.
So I'm trying to get the time straight here. The co-pilot says as he's about to enter Vietnamese airspace, good night. And then how long a time is it between that good night and all that happened subsequently, the loss of contact with the airplane? It wasn't a long period of time, was it?
No. In fact, there are various reports on this, and it's hard to nail it down completely. But what we're seeing is that the ACARS went offline minutes before that last radio transmission was made. And also, they're seeing is, again, this has been reported, that the transponder was turned to the off position prior to that last radio call. So these are things that we are hearing about, but, you know, again, there's so many things that are coming out, especially today. There was some new stuff that was published that some of it's not accurate. And that timeline is, it's been defined, but again, they seem to be moving that back and forth. So as we know now, the radio call was made that said goodnight by the co-pilot. They did confirm it was the co-pilot that said that. However, the ELT, the transponder was turned off prior to that radio call.
Well, if it were a fire, you wouldn't calmly say good night, would you?
No, you wouldn't. And I just want to bring you to another. There's another example of an aircraft that was taxiing out, and this was about 4 or 5 years ago, and it was connected to the tug, and they were being pushed back, and the tug driver noticed that there was smoke coming out from the belly of the aircraft. Things were already happening inside the airplane, but the flight crew didn't know about it at that point. So it took time to progress to get to them. In other words, the event was taking place, but the cockpit wasn't aware of it. Actually, it was the tug driver that made the pilots aware that, hey, you're on fire. And they got everybody off the airplane safely. They were on the ground. So an event could start slowly, you know, and affect various systems. And then finally, you know, the catastrophic event takes place.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. You can use that if you can't get through on our phone lines. We also enjoy hearing messages from you on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Bruce Roger is our guest. We're talking about Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, its disappearance. He is a pilot. He is president of Aero Consulting Experts, and he has a 25-year history of flying for the military and commercial airlines. He also has worked closely with the Secret Service to plan and execute presidential transportation requirements. Let's go next to Chris in Oshkosh. Hi, Chris.
Yes, hello.
Yes, hi, Chris. Go ahead.
I got to get you back onto my telephone here. I apologize. Okay. You know, I am also a 20,000-hour a large body aircraft pilot who spends an awful lot of my time transiting oceans of this planet. So I believe I speak with some knowledge of what's going on here.
I'm sure you do.
Everybody wants to infer that something, you know, caused by humankind, the crew, or other people on board is what happened, when in fact, you know, really nothing is known. You have posited the electrical fire scenario, which I think is still valid. By the way, unless something new came out since I last heard, they have recanted on the idea that any failures occurred prior to the last radio sign-off. They're now saying that everything occurred after that. Anyway, let me bounce one more off of you. Do you recall a few years ago, really better than a decade ago, a 747 over the Pacific suffered a cargo door failure, ripped a large bit of structure away. That airplane was able to achieve Honolulu, but it ripped several rows of seats out of the airplane. Mm-hmm. There was some loss of life with that.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember
in the
incident.
Event of catastrophic structural failure.
Mm-hmm. So, what, Chris?
You know, I'm sorry that I'm panting. I had to run to get to the phone.
Yeah. What do you think happened, Chris? What do you think
happened? In the event of a structural failure, it's conceivable that leads to transponder antennas and so forth would have failed. I don't know how the ACARS antennas are attached, but it would conceivably do away with transponder antennas.
Mm-hmm.
It is also conceivable that the very first thing that crew would have done in that circumstance is to de-automate the airplane. If you hear a large bang, the airplane depressurizes and it begins shaking violently. You don't tell the autopilot what to do. You de-automate the airplane and fly it by hand so that you have a sense of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
They would have immediately made that turn back in the heading of you know, what they perceived to be a safe airport, and things would have manifested from that point. Conceivably, had there been a problem that developed with the crew oxygen system or a failure to immediately get on the oxygen, the crew would have lost consciousness and the airplane would have flown on completely on its own. Mm. I'm troubled by reports that the airplane climbed to an altitude of 45,000, well in excess of its service ceiling. That's not something a crew would have done intentionally. Mm-hmm. It's not something a hijacker would have done intentionally. It's something that could only happen by accident. If the airplane climbed to 45 because it was displaced by the crew flying it manually, if they subsequently lost consciousness, the aircraft could have entered into the altitude oscillations that we have heard reported as, you know, people that don't know what they're talking about say as a sign that was being flown intelligently, but it could have just been an airplane wandering around on its own before it found a stable altitude and pressed on until it ran out of fuel.
Mm-hmm. Chris, thank you for your call.
Chris, yes, thank you. And you bring up some very good points. First off, the altitude excursions. The 777 really would struggle to get from 43,000 feet to 45,000 feet. That 2,000 feet margin is, I know it doesn't sound like much, 2,000 feet, but at that altitude, at that weight, it is quite a bit, especially for this airplane. So getting up to 45,000 feet that you've heard reports of, I'm also a little skeptical on those reports because it would be a hard thing for that airplane to achieve quickly. As far as the rapid decompression scenario is concerned, I also am a subscriber to that. The time of useful consciousness, as we call it, this is when you lose cabin pressure and how much time you have to put your oxygen mask on varies from person to person, but you can plan on maybe 15 seconds at that altitude. So you basically have 15 seconds to put your mask on. And if you did that, and let's say there was a problem with the oxygen system, which we have seen before in a Learjet incident here in America, if there was oxygen that was compromised, you would basically be passed out in about 15, 20 seconds. So, there is that kind of scenario that could play out. And before the pilots lost consciousness, they put a command into the autopilots. Airlines do it differently. And Chris, I know you said they would hand fly the airplane. I've seen a lot of scenarios of this in the simulator as we practice rapid decompression quite a bit in training. Basically, the pilots would keep the airplane on the autopilot and turn the altitude heading down and start the airplane descending immediately. They would also change the course of the airplane by using the autopilots. This makes it a smooth transition and probably deploy the speed brake to get down as quickly as possible. If they did that, started that, lost consciousness, then the airplane would hit those parameters and then just recover itself.
Mm. Thank you very much for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, its disappearance this hour of the program. And our guest is Bruce Roger. He is a pilot, president of Aero Consulting Experts. He has been in aviation for a number of years, instructor pilot at the U.S. Air Force Test Pilot School, was assigned to the Air Force One detail. He's a reserve pilot for the U.S. Air Force and is a pilot for a major commercial airline. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show and Facebook is the Kathleen Dunn Show. More calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go back to phone calls now. Joe and Perry Deshane. Hi, Joe.
Hi. See, two things. I understand the 777 can fly on one engine. Can its range be extended by saving fuel with just one engine running? And what would that do to the search area? And also, if it did hit the water, what kind of effect on the debris field would its angle of impact and speed have? If it went straight in, would the fuselage maybe not necessarily break up too much, so a lot of flotation items in the cabin not come to the surface?
Well, Joe, thanks for your question. As far as we've seen an airplane land in the Hudson River with Captain Sully Sullenberger, who did an excellent job landing that airplane, and that airplane stayed completely intact. But that airplane was glided down and was put down on the water nice and easy. Again, amazing job by Captain Sullenberger. If this airplane was on its own will, in other words, there was nobody commanding it, who knows how it would hit the water. if it would hit it straight 90 degrees or if it would land flat. And you're right. If it hit pretty hard, there would be a debris field, and we probably would have discovered that by now. And also to remind you that the emergency locator transmitters, those beacons that transmit an emergency signal that can be tracked by other airplanes and by satellites, have not gone off. Those are water-activated. So we should be getting those pings if it did hit the water. As far as flying on single engine, the airplane does a great job flying single engine, and it can make it 3 hours on a single engine without any problems whatsoever. Would it extend its range? Probably not. And that would be a very technical matter to get into because of the way the fuel is distributed through the airplane and all that.
So if it didn't hit the water, where did it hit?
Well, if it didn't hit the water, it could have it could be on land someplace.
Oh my!
It could have landed on an airfield. It could, and there's a lot of jungle and there's a lot of desert. A lot of possibilities that airplane could have landed at.
And would it be harder to find it? Is it easier to find it eventually on land than it would be in the ocean?
It would be, because now we can use a lot of our satellites and tracking equipment to physically take photos from space and find the debris field.
Hmm. Thanks very much for your call, Joe. Peter in Stoughton, hi.
Good afternoon. Prior to the news about the transponder being turned off, I was speculating that perhaps the plane had been struck by a piece of space junk. You have a small object with a lot of energy and a lot of speed behind it and no way of tracking it or its source, which leads me to my question. Why is it possible for whoever to turn the transponders off in these planes?
Oh, that's a good question.
Okay, great question, Peter. I see space debris quite a bit as I'm flying over the Pacific Ocean or the Atlantic Oceans. It's quite the show. The debris comes into the atmosphere and it burns up. For debris to hit an airplane, my goodness, it would be like taking a dart and trying to, you know, pinpoint it into an exact little tiny square inch of space. It'd be very difficult to do that from a mile away. So I'm not going to discount that, but it's probably very far-fetched. The odds of space debris hitting an aircraft would take place. You have two objects that are moving very quickly. As far as the other part of that, the transponder on-off switch is installed in the airplane. When the airplane's on the ground, and you have all these multitude of airplanes at an airport, and if everyone's transponders were going off, it would interfere with the transponders of those that are airborne and create this big cluster of transponders for air traffic control radar to see. Now, I'm going to caveat that by saying some airports in the U.S. and in Europe have ground radars, and they specifically want you to turn your transponder on before you even leave the gate before taxiing, so that way they can track you on the ground using your transponder. And this is a great system, because if there's low visibility, they can't see you physically from the tower. They can actually see you on ground radar. It's fairly new technology. It's not everywhere yet. In those airports that don't have this technology, they definitely want you to turn the transponder off so you're not interfering with other airplanes that are flying as far as air traffic control is concerned.
Mm. Thank you, Peter, so much. Phil is next in Hebron. Hi, Phil.
Good afternoon. I just have a quick question for you. I've been reading what the New York Times puts up on this and then a lot of the stuff on the on television. And they had an Australian expert on it, an aviation expert. And he said, you need to understand our oceans are vast and very deep in this area of the world. And he said, the lands are desolate and extensive. And they were speaking about how long the search will go on before there's constraints, economic or otherwise, to continue to do it. And I took from that he felt there's a very real possibility we may never have the perfect answer. We may never find the majority of the plane, and that may be the answer. I want to know what you thought of that possibility.
Phil, I think it's a possibility, and we don't know where this airplane went down. We don't know if it's landed on a remote runway someplace, which I think would be, you know, almost akin to science fiction, because you'd have to have all this ground service equipment to service the airplane, and somebody would notice that. If it's in a jungle someplace, I think our satellites will find it. If it is in the water, way off course, and those oceans are very deep, you're absolutely right. We may never get to the bottom of this, and it will be one of the great aviation mysteries.
Mm-hmm. But it sure will be.
I'm hopeful that with our great technology and with the world's powers coming together on the search effort, that we will locate this aircraft.
So what do you think? What do you think about the way all of this is being explained? I can understand the family members' complete and utter frustration and heartbreak over all of this. Is there something to what they're saying, that they're not being told the truth? Is the Malaysian government handling this the way that they ought to be, in a top-notch fashion, or not?
Well, Kathleen, you know, you have a lot of chefs in the kitchen right now, and Malaysia is trying their best. However, there's you know, you have the United States, you have China, you have Japan, you have all these world powers that are coming together and descending into this area, and they're trying to do the best job they can, but it's difficult. We have reports today that one of our P-3 Orions in the Navy, which has great tracking devices, wasn't able to take off from the aircraft carrier because they couldn't get clearance into the airspace. Again, it's very complicated, and a lot of people trying to help, but you know, when you have too many chefs in the kitchen, sometimes it doesn't go as smoothly as you'd like it to go.
Mm. Well, I've also heard reports that some nations are not being very helpful because they don't want information out there about their radar systems, their defensive systems, et cetera.
That's true. And let me just bring you to the example I spoke about earlier with the Chinese satellite images. They held onto those images for quite some time. Now, I'm just speculating, but when you show the world what you have, then you're kind of tilting your hat. Okay, we've got these satellites. We have them here. And this is the resolution of their pictures. So you're showing what you have. And, you know, and that might be restricting some of the information flow.
Let's go next to Scott in La Crosse. Hello, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
I've got a question and a very quick follow-up, which I'll just ask right now. My first initial question is about the flight simulator. And there have been these stories coming out. Like, the first I heard was that they had, that this simulator had records of 5 trips that this pilot had programmed flying out over the Indian Ocean. And then we hear later, today I think it was, that the records had been erased back to February 3rd. Those files had been deleted from his flight simulator. So obviously both of these things can't be true. And then I also heard this story that in programming for their onboard computer for their flight, they had programmed in this deviation from the course. And there again, I didn't hear any follow-up on that. And I guess my question about that is this just bad reporting? Are people putting these things out from somebody's idle speculation and they're reporting it as fact? And then the follow-up was, the other night on PBS, I heard former Commissioner James Hall of the NTSB asked the rhetorical question, why do they have transponders on a jet, an airliner like the 777 that you can turn off? Why wouldn't they just be on steady state always? Under what circumstances would you need to take a transponder out?
Thank you, Scott.
Okay, Scott, just to follow up on your last question quickly, because I've kind of touched on it a bit. Transponders have that on-off capability, so we have the capability to turn the transponder off when we're on the ground. So if the airport doesn't have a ground radar interrogating a transponder, we have to turn that system off. Otherwise, we'll be pinging. And you can imagine all these airplanes taxiing around that are pinging, and air traffic control approach or what have you is looking at that, and they don't need to see that because we're already on the ground safe and sound. They don't need to track us anymore. So that's why we have the ability to turn it off. I hope that answers that question. As far as the flight simulators and deleted files, this is new information that we're just getting today. And I'm sure with the experts that we have here in this country and other countries, they'll be able to resurrect some of those files, and I'm sure that'll help us out quite a bit. The other question you talked about, the programming of the FMCs, that is something that we do on a regular basis. We do that to change destinations. If we have a sick passenger on board or if we have an emergency, we do it with when we're told to change course, there's a thunderstorm. There's a lot of reasons why we would reprogram the FMCs, and it's something that we do, several times during a flight. And when we do that, this is what's interesting here. When we do that regular event, that event is not reported to anybody on the ground.
Oh.
So I know this reporting that's coming out about the pilots putting in this new course, executing it, and them receiving it on the ground is not something that I'm tracking on very well, because I know that when I do that in an airplane, a Boeing aircraft, it's not reported through the ACARS to anybody. The only way that it would be is if I typed it into the ACARS. Now, this is not the flight management system. This is the actual chat room that I spoke about earlier. If I typed a message there saying, hey, I'm changing course to this waypoint and this waypoint, and hit the send button, then absolutely you would see it on the ground.
Okay. Thanks, Scott, very much for your call. We'll take more in a moment. And this hour of the program, we're talking about what everybody's talking about, not just here in Wisconsin, but all over the world. What happened to Malaysia Airlines Flight 370? Our guest is Bruce Roger. He's president of Aero Consulting Experts. He's a longtime pilot, commercial pilot, and also he's been a pilot for the Air Force. He was also... He has quite a history here. He was an instructor pilot at the U.S. Air Force Test Pilot School, Edwards Air Force Base, California, was assigned to the Air Force One detail. He has worked closely with the Secret Service to plan and execute presidential transportation requirements. He's a Gulf War veteran, still serving in the U.S. Air Force as a reserve pilot. So he is our guest this hour, and it's helpful to have somebody who knows the airplane, right, to knows about flying as a guest. Bruce Roger is our guest. More phone calls momentarily. One line open, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Let's go next to Susan in Mount Horeb. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I'm not sure that I have the actual timetable down that they're talking about for this airplane, but from what I've gathered, supposedly the amount of fuel that they had when they started was for about 8 hours, and they had already been in the air for about an hour before it started turning back. And I'm wondering, I've seen the maps where they have the circles around to show how many, like 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours out and stuff. Would there have been enough fuel at all, like, had been from 7 hours left of fuel for it to get to, like, Africa at all? Or is it going to just go between, like they show, it'll end at the in the sea between Africa and India?
Well, Susan, without actually, I haven't looked at the recent maps, but I do know what you're talking about. And it would be difficult with the fuel on board for it to reach Africa.
Thanks very much, Susan, for the call. Melissa on email, the conversation got me wondering, if a pilot did lose consciousness, they could slump in many directions. Could it be that the pilot slumped forward in the seat, and could that body weight falling onto the steering column direct the airplane up to 45,000 feet elevation? I don't know how the steering column in a plane works, but I imagine that the guest does. Bruce?
Well, yes. The steering column, if you were to push down on it, push forward, in other words, the airplane would go down. If you were to pull back on it, the airplane would go up. The pilots are, even when we're at cruise, we are strapped into our seats. We have our seat belts. We wear them all the time. My goodness, you're traveling at 500 miles an hour. You want to have a seat belt on, and I recommend that for my passengers as well. And we have them nice and snug, and we're also at cruise. We're backed off a little bit on our seats. So we're not really close to the column as if we were landing the airplane. If you were to slump over, let's say something happened and you slumped onto the yoke, if the autopilots were engaged, the airplane would continue flying on the autopilots. If they were not engaged, then absolutely the yoke could press forward and the airplane nose would go down.
Okay. Rich in New Berlin. Hi.
Incidentally, just to back up here, sorry, Kathleen, on that last question, if that happened when this incident occurred, the airplane would have been found in the Gulf of Thailand, because that if the pilots were slumped over on the yoke, that's where the impact would have occurred. We would have found the aircraft by now.
I see. Okay. Rich, go ahead.
Oh, I'm wondering if this plane could be on the ground in, let's say, eastern Afghanistan or eastern Iran, because the pilots knew how to avoid radar or their dead spots.
Rich, that's also a great question, and it's something that we absolutely have to pay attention to, without doubt. There was reports today that Israeli air defense and their radar systems have been boosted to a higher state of awareness. And definitely, it is a possibility. I say it's remote, but it is a possibility, not necessarily maybe in Iran, but maybe in another country someplace. And everybody needs to be aware of this. And I know our State Department and the world is paying close attention to that. Just in case it did happen this way, we are on alert to protect ourselves from something bad happening in this direction.
Hmm. Well, what would you have done with all of those passengers, though?
Well, Kathleen, that's a difficult question to answer.
Right. It's an unknown, right? How long does this story stay with us? It is amazing how many people are just following this, because it just doesn't happen day by all over the world. How long will we stay with it, Bruce?
I think it's going to stay with us until we find the airplane or have some shred of evidence of what happened to our 777. It's an unusual aircraft event. You know, most aircraft events that take place, we find it. We know where it's at. We see it. We have black boxes. We have passengers that are walking off the airplane, in some cases not. We have an end. And in this particular situation, we don't have an end. So I think it's going to be with us until we get to that point.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Rich, for the call. David in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. How you doing?
All right, David. How are you?
Pretty good. My question is not a technical aviation question, but I'm sure your guests can respond with a technical answer. I'm just thinking on the planes that went down, per se, during 9/11, especially the one in Pennsylvania, and how much communication there was between the passengers and either family or friends. I mean, they were calls and calls and calls. And, you know, since we become a society, we know the expression, you know, attached at the hip, but I mean, with our phones and all our communication devices, we're attached at the palm with these things. It kind of makes us speculate more that it was something catastrophic, and the window to react must have been just mere seconds, because I refuse to believe that a plane carrying almost 300 people, someone didn't try to call a loved one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see your point. It's a valid point, Bruce.
It is a valid point. And remember, at this point where this event took place, when they said goodbye to Malaysia and trying to establish communications with Vietnam, that there are really no cell signals, cell towers to receive a cell signal in that airspace. So you have that going for you. The other thing is, if there was a catastrophic event like a rapid decompression, there's only enough oxygen out of those Dixie cups that we've all seen demonstrated by our great flight attendants that drop out of the ceiling. That only lasts for 20, 30 minutes. It's enough time to get the airplane down to a reasonable atmosphere so everyone can breathe normally. If that didn't happen and you were flying at higher altitude for some time, eventually you would lose consciousness, and that would explain why maybe later on in the flight, a phone call wasn't made when they were getting close to land.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of the background checks that have been done? They've been received from the home countries, I understand, of all passengers except Ukraine and Russia. And authorities are saying there's no information of significance.
Well, absolutely everybody needs on this airplane needs to be checked. Not only do the passengers need to be checked, but the baggage handlers, the gate handlers, the caterers, anybody that had anything to do with this flight needs to be investigated, because we have to clear them so we can eliminate any possible, activity that brought this thing down by a man-made event. So everybody needs to have a background check, without doubt.
Yeah. Well,
and you have to go beyond the passengers, by the way.
Yeah.
As I said.
Okay. Well, Bruce, I know you have to take a flight here. So
I do.
Thank you so much for being with us. You were just a wealth of information, and I hope we find out what happened.
I do too, Kathleen. It's an unfortunate event, and I'm confident that we will. And also, thank you very much for having me on your show.
Yeah, our pleasure. We're just going to take phone calls. Everybody has a theory. It's what we're talking about now. So we're just going to take your phone calls for the remainder 2 minutes of this program. But we thank Bruce so much for being with us. He is president of Aero Consulting Experts. He's a pilot of a major commercial airline and has to take a trip in one of those airlines right now. But he's been an Air Force pilot, has flown most aircraft in the U.S. Air Force inventory, fighter jets, bombers, cargo, and trainer, instructor pilot at the U.S. Air Force Test Pilot School, assigned to Air Force One detail, Gulf War veteran, and still serving the U.S. Air Force as a reserve pilot. So what is your theory? We have a couple minutes here. We're just going to take phone calls before we head up to the news. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. It sounds from our calls so far that you're following this very closely. Dan in Rice Lake, hi.
Good afternoon. I would just like to say this is wild country. Back in World War II, a bunch of folks stationed in New Guinea, which is not very far away from where this plane made its turn, just went for a joyride one afternoon, and they were lost in the jungle for months. Mm. It took them months, and they came down amongst headhunters. And also, as recently as 1961, Nelson Rockefeller's son was captured by headhunters in the jungle less than 300 miles from where this plane made its alleged turn, and was never found except for parts of his skeleton. And if you don't believe that, you can read about it in the current issue of the Smithsonian Magazine.
Ooh.
That's
and
all.
What about the World War II? What about the World War II pilots? Were they found? Were they alive still?
They walked out to the edge island that they were on, and then were found on the island by Japanese military people.
Yeah, remarkable. Thank you, Dan. And we'll get a hold of that Smithsonian. Thank you. Shirley in Eau Claire, hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right, Shirley, how are you?
Oh, I'm pretty good. I'm listening about that pilot that was talking on about the aircraft. You know, something like that. I've never seen happen like that before, but I think they'll find it, though.
You think they'll find the airplane?
I think they will.
How long will it take?
Well, I say at least another couple weeks.
Okay. Thank
That's
you.
That's what I wanted to talk to the pilot about, you know, but then he had a trip to go on.
He had to fly, so he couldn't stay. Okay, Shirley, thank you very much for your call. Let's go to Christine in Gurnee. Hi, Christine.
Hi there.
Hi. What do you think, Christine?
I just was wondering, I know the plane, said goodnight to the Malaysian air traffic controllers, but no one has said what the response has been from the Vietnamese air traffic controllers, in that I'm sure they were expecting the flight to enter their airspace at a certain time, and it didn't, and wouldn't that raise some suspicion or
right.
something?
Yeah, right. I haven't heard news reports on how the Vietnamese responded to this. They were not quite in for radar to pick up their signal at that point, but maybe they have made a comment and I've just missed it. Okay, well, I'm glad we did this show. We're certainly all talking about it. I thought, do we want to do a show on this? And then KP said, let's do a show, and were all talking about it. So it was interesting, wasn't it? I just hope for the sake of all those families, it must be horrendous for them that there is some closure here for them so they can sleep and live again. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing the show and for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee.